Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, March 2nd, 2016. It's the day after Super Tuesday. And this podcast, at least the opening part of it, is aimed at people who voted for Trump. And if you know somebody, I invite you to share this with them. We learned a bitter lesson in California.
Who can take California?
Who can take California?
Set it on its ear. Stop it in its tracks and take it out of gear. The girly man.
The girly man.
The girly man can.
I urge you to beware of celebrity strongman candidates.
Messes with my mind and makes my world a pain in the you know what. Who can take a budget?
Who can take a budget?
Put it all askew.
Put it all askew.
Bow to special interests and a lobbyist or two. The girly man,
the girly man,
the girly man can.
That's my buddy from Silicon Valley, Loose Bruce Kerr, and the song is Girly Man, a send-up of the old Candyman song by Sammy Davis Jr. And he produced that while Arnold Schwarzenegger was governor of California. And I really think that he offers an important lesson to people who think that Donald Trump is going to be an agent of change, that he's going to blow up the boxes, that he's going to build a big wall and make Mexico pay for it. Because Arnold Schwarzenegger entered politics as an amateur in California, riding only on his celebrity status. And voters were angry, just kind of like the national mood today. They were angry at Governor Gray Davis for backpedaling on a car tax, and there were other issues in play as well. And so once Daryl Issa paid for the recall and thought he was going to ride it to become governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger went around the whole political process. He announced his candidacy on the Jay Leno Tonight Show. And he didn't run a campaign like other people did that's very similar to what Trump is doing. He relied on his high name recognition and his broad promises, which were not based on any policy or plans whatsoever, to carry him into office. And we had this bizarre recall. Arianna Huffington ran. Gary, who's that little guy from television? I can't think of his name. I mean, there was a former stripper who ran. It was really wild. Now, there were over 100 candidates. The Republican primary peaked at 17. But when you think about the combination of celebrity and an actor who is posing as a strongman. Now, at least in Schwarzenegger's case, he had done steroids, he was a champion weightlifter, and physically he was a strong man. Donald Trump doesn't appear to have any real physical strength, but he makes up for it with ego-driven bluster. And let me just take a moment to tell you how badly Arnold Schwarzenegger performed as governor of California. He came in saying he was going to cut up the credit cards, he was going to balance the budget, cut expenses, and put California on a firm footing. And he did cut up the credit cards, and then he turned around and passed a $15 billion bond measure, and Jerry Brown has finally paid that off. It was a bond measure used to pay for current expenses. And it was really bad budgeting. And Arnold Schwarzenegger was unable to lead even members of his own party. And at a crucial point around 2006-2007, before the big meltdown, Arnold decided he really did need to raise taxes, even though he had pledged not to do so. And the members of his own party had enough votes in the legislature to block that. And they were all loyal to Grover Norquist, who had gotten them to sign his no-tax pledge. And they nearly bankrupted the state of California, put us through years of misery that were finally corrected when Jerry Brown became governor again and passed a tax measure that the voters approved. And the most telling comment about Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor of California came from the Democratic leader Don Perata in the state Senate at the time. And he said, Arnold Schwarzenegger is a leader with no followers. And while Trump is enjoying this really irrational exuberance, to quote Greenspan, of the Republican primary voters today, he doesn't have a clue about how to operate in Washington, how to write a bill, get it through committee, get it passed, and sign it into law. And he did it again last night. I was watching as he hosted a victory rally / news conference. And he was introduced by big fat Chris Christie. He's his bully buddy from New Jersey. And Chris is now the bottom, if you know what I mean, in this little tryst. And it was so weird. There are photos all over Facebook today of Trump with Chris Christie standing behind him with various perplexed facial expressions as Trump rambled through this litany of how he's going to build a wall, beautiful wall, Mexico's going to pay for it, blah, 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 blah. And Christie was trying to keep a straight face. And he was unable to do that for the entire time. Somebody grabbed a short piece of video that shows him visually squirming as Trump is making some of these bizarre statements. And my favorite is posted by a Peter Zakari. I don't know him, but it's up on my Facebook page. And the top panel is a picture from last night of Christie and Trump. And Christie's standing there like the political wife, you know, just loyal but never says anything. And below it, and paired up with the Trump-Christie photo, is a picture from the Hogan's Heroes TV show of Colonel Klink in the Trump position and Sergeant Schultz in the Christie position. And if you don't know that TV show, I'm not going to take time to explain it, but you can find it on one of your cable channels. It was a hoot back in the 1960s, early 70s. I guess it was in the 60s. And it was based in a concentration camp. And this Sergeant Schultz was just an obsequious guy who always took orders. And whenever things went wrong, he said, "I see nothing. I know nothing." And that's kind of the position that Christie is in today. And I'm not alone. There are people all over the place asking if Chris Christie has lost his mind. But this is pure political opportunism. He sees a winner surfacing, and he doesn't really care about Trump's policies. That was just stuff for him to run on and talk about in the debates. And I want to congratulate the Gannett newspapers in the state of New Jersey, because they have published editorials as a group urging Christie to resign, since he has become Donald Trump's stooge. I doubt if he will, but it's interesting to note the reaction in his home state. So when we look at the primary results on the Republican side, it wasn't that surprising. Ted Cruz won Texas, and his bonus was that he beat Trump in Oklahoma. Marco Rubio was the leader of the Minnesota caucus outcome, and that is the only victory that he can put on his scoreboard to date. But it was clearly a Trump evening. 4, 5, 6, 7 states, he was the top vote getter. Now, he peaked at 43% in Alabama, and the other candidates picked up delegates as well. So in these races, it's the delegates are assigned proportionally. As we hit mid-March, the states have rules of winner-take-all, and that can really build the pace and momentum for the Trump juggernaut. So it's not that surprising what happened on Super Tuesday. And as I mentioned yesterday, the states involved in Super Tuesday are different than those that were in the picture in 2012. And that's one explanation for the heavy Southern representation in the Super Tuesday primaries. So a little bit more on Trump. The numbers show that if he continues at this pace, that he may be able to claim that he's wrapped up the nomination sometime toward the end of March or in early April. March 15th, there are 4 key states: Illinois, Ohio, Florida, and Missouri. And that could be a point where Trump will be the presumptive nominee. So it's moving very quickly, and the efforts by Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz to sink Donald Trump by finally telling the truth about him are too little, too late. And the New York Times is piling on today. This is a pretty brash editorial for the gray lady. They say, the Republicans seem to be reeling, unable or unwilling to comprehend that a shady, bombastic liar is hardening the image of their party as a symbol of intolerance and division. They are leaning in unbelievable numbers toward a man whose quest for the presidency revolves around targeting religious and racial minorities, people with disabilities, who flirts with white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan, who ridicules and Sanders those... That was interesting. Ridicules and Sanders? No. Ridicules and slanders those who disagree with him. His opponents, meanwhile, have rushed to adopt his anger-filled message. It's small wonder that Republican leaders don't seem to know quite what to say. And the Times lectures the Republicans. There were opportunities to stop this early on. Possessed of a crack team of researchers, the Republican Party did not turn its resources on investigating this man's record of falsehoods and business failures. When struggling families worry that their children's American dream will be obscured behind a mountain of debt, college debt, even a passing reference to the scam that is Trump University would surely have resonated many months ago. It may now be too late to alter the course that Trump has set, but Republican leaders would be derelict not to try. So here, the Times is saying that the leaders of the Republican Party should ignore what appears to be the will of their party members, or at least the people who show up and want to be Republicans on primary day, and just go back to the old smoke-filled room brokered deals. That shows how dangerous they believe Trump is. Now, the Times has its own problem with Trump, because back in January, the editorial board met with him, and some of his comments were regarded as on the record, and some were treated as off the record. And one of the off-the-record remarks, according to a leak of a recording from the editorial board meeting, and that's published by BuzzFeed, Trump told them that his extreme position on deporting immigrants is not anything he would necessarily carry out in real post-election life, but it could be the starting point for a negotiation. So the Times is caught here because there are many people, there are Trump haters on the left, Trump haters on the right, and opportunists in the Republican Party who would like to know if he really said that. And he has made comments like that in the past. For example, he told something similar to the Washington Examiner in the same month, January of this year. So the Times is in a pickle there of its own creation. Now to the Democratic side. Again, it wasn't terribly surprising. There was a disappointment, kind of like Iowa. Bernie Sanders came extremely close, within one percentage point, of tying or beating Hillary Clinton in the state of Massachusetts. And Massachusetts, of course, is near Vermont and near New Hampshire, so that the momentum that Sanders has, he did win Vermont by 86%, and that wasn't a surprise, but it should have bled over into Massachusetts. He certainly made great gains there, but he didn't pull it off. He did win the caucuses in Colorado by a huge margin, by 19 points, 59 to 40, and he beat Clinton by 10 points in Oklahoma. So, and I didn't mention that he won the Minnesota caucus, did I? 60-40. Okay, so it was really pretty much along the lines of predictions. And typically, the corporate media is trotting out analyses that say that, well, Hillary's got the real momentum here, and the path to victory or to the nomination for Bernie Sanders is all but blocked. Now, some of this is accurate. Sanders is not scoring well with black voters. Hillary was picking up as much as 80% of black voters in Georgia, Alabama, and Tennessee. And, you know, again, Massachusetts was kind of a litmus test to see if his, described revolution is starting to gain any ground. So there's no question here that Sanders needs to beef up his support among minorities, and he's got to gain an edge over Hillary Clinton and win some big states in the next few weeks. states like those that vote on March 15th, Illinois, Missouri, Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. Now, I want you to know, I hope this isn't too shocking to my longtime listeners, I don't believe I have ever, in a favorable light, quoted a comment from Ann Coulter. I really despise her, and I don't use that term for many people, but she is an odious troll who parades across the Fox News Channel with a lot of really annoying comments. And it's not just that I disagree with her, it's the tone and the snark with which she delivers it. And she's this contradictory package, you know, she's always in a miniskirt showing off her legs and coming across as some sort of a right-wing sex bomb as she promotes hardline Puritan morals and standards as part of her political message. At any rate, Ann Coulter put out a tweet last night that I agree with. And it's simple. It's less than 140 characters. Hillary is winning all the states where Dems don't have a prayer in the general election. Bernie is winning the Democratic swing states. And that is a critical factor. Because the fact that Hillary won Texas last night is not going to deliver it to any Democrat, Clinton or Sanders, this November. I think that's a pretty strong foregone conclusion. And so some of these victories are meaningless. The other issue is we have to look carefully at the delegate count. And superdelegates are lumped in by the pro-Clinton forces and sympathetic media to make it look like she's already won. But the actual pledged delegate count after Super Tuesday is 459 for Clinton and 352 for Sanders. That is a gap of 107 delegates. That is not a runaway train. So keep that in mind, because there are a lot of people who are trying to spin this up and get people to give up on the Sanders campaign. Yesterday, I cited a snarky op-ed from a Hillary supporter who was talking down to people like me as Hillary haters. And by the way, I don't despise or hate Hillary Clinton. I just disagree with her and don't support her. But Maria Cardona, writing in The Guardian today, notes that she supports Hillary and she regards her as the likely candidate. But she also is pretty balanced here and fair. And I'm not using that as a jibe at Fox News. She says Sanders is raising a lot of money from individual donors. He has an important, passionate following and will continue going for the long haul. He should, she writes. The country will need every Democrat, liberal, moderate, and conservative from every demographic and walk of life, every independent, and any other American who wants to restore civility and sanity to our national debate if we are to defeat Trump in the fall. So while Clinton may have done well last night, I'm thrilled that Sanders is staying in this race, and I hope he continues to focus on all the critical issues that he and Hillary have been talking about. We need to mobilize and energize our voters throughout the entirety of Democratic Party process in order to lay the groundwork for an epic get-out-the-vote operation in the fall. And here's an important comment. Clinton supporters should welcome Sanders staying in this race and not seem to want to push him out. While our conversation has been civil and downright tame compared to the circus of the Republicans, there have been some harsh exchanges between Sanders supporters and those of Clinton. This needs to stop. We're not each other's nemesis. We have to focus our energy and fire on defeating the Republican nominee. Well, I agree, and I don't like to see the sniping that goes on between supporters of Clinton and Sanders. But I don't think you can actually objectively figure out who the provocateurs are. It seems to be pretty evenly divided. The Supreme Court today heard oral arguments in the critical Texas TRAP case. TRAP, that stands for Regulations to Restrict Abortion Clinics. And the court watchers are all looking at Justice Anthony Kennedy. As you know, with the death of Justice Scalia, if the court splits on this issue 4-4, the lower court ruling will stand and the bad Texas law will stand. But if Justice Kennedy makes it a 5-3 vote, in favor of abortion rights, this could be a landmark decision to preserve those rights for some years to come. And it's another reason why the Republicans are so committed to blocking any nomination by Barack Obama to the court. But what is a head-scratcher for me is that the news accounts, and I haven't had a chance to go deep on the Supreme Court arguments, I may know more tomorrow, but Justice Kennedy is reported to say that it would help to know how many abortions could be performed in the clinics that would remain open if this Texas law is allowed to become fully effective. And he hinted that it might be a good idea to return the case to the lower courts to develop more evidence. Well, I'm not too sanguine about that approach, but it's worth noting that's what the justice said in the oral arguments today. And it's so hard for me, and I'm an admitted partisan on this. I am an unmitigated supporter of the right of a woman to choose an abortion. But I don't see how any objective person can say that the Texas law does not place a quote-unquote undue burden on the constitutional right to an abortion. And if an undue burden is properly defined, it would include unnecessary health regulations that have the purpose or effect of presenting a substantial obstacle to a woman seeking an abortion. Now, I didn't make up that language. That is a quote from the 1992 current precedent on abortion, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And to me, it's very clear that the Texas law intentionally places a burden on access to abortion clinics. And so I hope that the court will strike it down, but we probably won't hear any more about this until the decision is handed down in June. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. And today I want to thank Kathleen Lowy, Mona Kobus, Anna Gordonier, and Kevin Beckley. They're all regular subscribers to this podcast, and I appreciate it. I invite you to join their ranks. I need some new subscribers here to keep all this going. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, then you select Become a Subscriber. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. If you take out a new annual subscription for $50, I let you choose from one of two bonus books, either The Burn Pits by Joe Hickman, which exposes the military negligence that exposed our troops in Iraq and Afghanistan to toxic smoke from these burn pits. And I have a fun book called A Field Guide to the F Word. And, of course, the F Word, the most powerful four letters in the English language. I'd be happy to send one of those to you if you simply take out a new annual subscription. And we're also supporting the Kickstarter drive to fund NewsBud. And NewsBud is the independent media outlet that we hope to launch later this year with your support. And we just hit 1,200 investors, backers, donors, whatever you like to call yourselves. And this is exciting. It is moving on up. We've raised about $120,000 toward our $950,000 goal. And I hope you will share this with your friends. Also, if you hear this before Thursday night, March 3rd at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, we will be doing a live video feed, and you can access that either at newsbud.com or at boilingfrogspost.com, and I hope you'll join us. Professor Mickey Huff, who is one of the managers of Project Censored, will be on with us to talk about how the mainstream media ignores critical stories and how important independent media outlets are. Well, yesterday I gave you some coverage of FBI Director James Comey's testimony before a House committee. And one of the things that had not surfaced at the time that I recorded my podcast was his admission of the boneheaded error, the "doh" moment that the FBI is responsible for in the San Bernardino investigation. And Comey finally coughed it up. He said there was a mistake made in the 24 hours after the attack because FBI personnel believe that by resetting the password on the iCloud related to the cell phone issued to the Farouk suspect by San Bernardino County, that it would help them unlock the phone. But in fact, when they changed that password, it locked them out and eliminated other means of getting in. So this is further evidence that the FBI is using the San Bernardino case as leverage, as a pretext, to demand limits to encryption and a backdoor on iPhones. And James Comey freely admitted that if he wins the court order in the San Bernardino case, that he'll use it again. And that's a direct contradiction of what he's been telling us for weeks now, that this is only about one phone, one time. Comey quoted as saying about backdoors, well, there's already a door on that iPhone. Essentially, we're saying to Apple, take the vicious guard dog away and let us pick the lock. And it's also been clarified that the San Bernardino County officials didn't change the password on their own. They did it only at the request of the FBI. And Comey acknowledged that in his testimony yesterday. The Senate, at least a Senate committee, has passed on a vote of 20 to something. I don't have the exact tally here. Let me get that right. They voted 14 to 6 to approve the Safe and Accurate Food Labeling Act, which is a lie, starting with its title. Because this is an effort at preemption. And what it means is that if this is signed into law, Monsanto and its backers will use this federal law to preempt any state or local regulation that requires labeling of food products made with genetically modified organisms, Frankenfoods. And this is an insidious effort to advance a corporate agenda at the expense of information that the public deserves to have. It is stonewalling, clear and simple. And Pat Leahy, senator from Vermont, said let the buyers make up their mind. He voted against the bill, saying that you seem to be saying to the world that GE, that's genetic engineered producers, have something to hide. The senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, who I've interviewed a couple of times, she's a nice woman, but she's voting with Monsanto and her agriculture industry in the state of Minnesota. And unfortunately, she's trying to turn science on its ear to justify her support for this bill. We can't ignore advances in science, she said. And she also addressed preemption by saying, I don't think we can have this patchwork of laws. Well, come on, that's pure bullshit. Because, for example, Vermont has a law that goes into effect later this year requiring GMO labeling on food products. And the food manufacturers, producers, processors could easily address this by just putting that information on all of their labels across the entire nation. That's what addresses the patchwork of laws, Senator Klobuchar. But they don't want us to have this information, and they're willing to buy senators, get them to say things that are irrational and contradictory. And while my junior senator, Barbara Boxer, is on her way out, she voted against the bill and thundered, this is a sham bill that will deny American families the right to know what they're feeding their kids. Well, it's nice to see a little bit of the old feisty Barbara Boxer in action. Now, we're finally getting a peek at some of the documents that we're told were seized from the Abbottabad hideout of Osama bin Laden. Yesterday, a cache of 113 documents were released, and I will link to an article that details this, but I'm running out of time today. And I'll just note that one of the juicy tidbits is that Osama bin Laden complimented President Barack Obama on his efforts to address climate change. And I think this is one of the most surprising, unexpected points of view that is now attributed to bin Laden. And I kind of chuckle when I see that. Also, they have posted and published a letter that he wrote to his father, which included instructions on what to do when he died or was killed. And the weird thing is that his dad has been dead for decades. So it's interesting. It's a little bit of a voyeur look. There is no reference to the alleged porn collection that he had in the hideout there in Abbottabad. And I still am uncomfortable with the way that whole episode played out and the fact that we have no proof. You know, there's no body. The evidence has been suppressed or, you know, kept secret. And it's just a very unsettling episode in recent American history. And finally today, a report from Jerusalem that a group of American rabbis aligned with the Reform movement in Judaism went to the Wailing Wall, and they were really treated to a very hostile reception in Israel by the Orthodox rabbinical establishment. Israeli lawmakers, both secular and Orthodox, have repeatedly disparaged the Reform group, questioning their Judaism and accusing them of promoting Jewish assimilation. And this is an ugly split inside the Jewish religion. But I think it's really important to note that Reform Judaism, which started in my hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio, at Hebrew Union College, is, I think, much more reflective of American Jews' political values. And this underscores a comment that I've made repeatedly, that the government of the State of Israel is captive to the most extreme, the most radical conservative elements. And in turn, the United States aligns its policies with those extreme, radical, conservative, orthodox elements of the Jewish religion. We believe in the separation of religion from the state, but they don't even attempt it in Israel. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the free podcast, and please share it with people who you think are likely to vote for Donald Trump.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until